This is a Brain Channel program from the Department of Neurosciences at the UC San Diego School of Medicine. Visit us at uctv.tv/brain to explore cutting-edge research, treatment options for conditions related to the nervous system, and the inner workings of the human mind.
Greetings, Bill Mobley for the Brain Channel on UCTV. Very pleased to have with me today here at UCSD an old friend and really a very distinguished colleague, Dr. David Zee. Let me just tell you a little bit about David. He is professor of neurology with joint appointments in ophthalmology, otolaryngology, head and neck surgery, and neuroscience at Johns Hopkins, where he has a laboratory and a great deal of research and clinical interests that are in part carried out at the Wilmer Eye Institute. He came to Hopkins as a medical student in 1965, and he's been there ever since. He specializes in vertigo, dizziness and imbalance, and David is among the absolutely best-known people in the world for his studies with colleagues on eye movements and changes in eye movements that occur in the setting of neurological disorders. His special interest is in learning and adaptation, how the brain compensates for disease states that impact it and that impact the way the eyes move. So here's a scientist and clinician who comes with colleagues to bring the tools of bioengineering, clinical neurology, brain physiology, and really to understand the brain and really to be able then to explore brain mechanisms and how they adapt to disease, but also how those adaptations would help to create new ways of helping people whose nervous system has been injured or affected by disease. David, it's great to have you here. We're delighted you've joined us for a visit at UCSD.
Good to be here.
David, really a unique combination of skills. Tell us how you came to be the person that you are. Tell us about something about your earlier life, your experiences, and really how that might have shaped your career.
Well, I came to medical school at Johns Hopkins in 1965, and I would say that my experience there and in my residency afterwards allowed me to meet some amazing people. And if I had to decide what really caused my or put my career on track, it was a combination of some mentors and some epiphanies when I heard people speak, and luck. First-year medical student, I fell in love with neuroanatomy, went to work with the head of the department, Dr. David Bodian. He showed me a lot of personal attention. When I was a resident, I heard a lecture by my scientific mentor, Dr. David Robinson, who taught me engineering concepts and physiology and went to work in his lab. And then I was very lucky to meet Dr. David Kogan and Dr. Frank Walsh. These were the fathers of neuro-ophthalmology in our country at that time, and they piqued my clinical interest. So it was a combination of meeting clinical people and basic scientists and physiologists all at the right time that pushed me into an area where I thought I could make a difference in clinical medicine using scientific tools.
You know, Hopkins is really famous for creating this constellation of brilliant scientists and devoted, incredibly talented clinicians. So it sounds like that it was a perfect place for you to land as a young person interested in building a career, to serve but also to discover.
So I think that's correct. It's all there at Hopkins and other places, and if you grab it, it's there.
Yeah.
And science and the clinic are put together, and that was why I chose that career.
And what's really not maybe evident to our viewers is what a rich, robust field of discovery sits there in front of the clinician. Every clinician, on an everyday basis almost, has a wealth of problems that present themselves. You've got to decide, though, don't you? You can't study everything. How did you choose to study what you did?
So I think it was the attraction of a field of scientific inquiry that combined some mathematical interests of mine and the ability to take what patients were telling me in the clinic to the laboratory. So it was this circumstance which allowed me to choose and find mentors in physiology and clinical work. And quite frankly, my area was really untouched at that time. So I picked a field that was in which there weren't many people. And sometimes you can find your niche that way. And it was also a time when this field was ready to come to the clinic. The physiology had been catching up, and clinicians were waiting to put it into practice at the bedside. And so it was just combined my interest in taking care of patients and learning how the brain works.
And I just would want to emphasize that last piece. It wasn't just that you cared for patients and just that you tried to understand, let's say, where their lesion was. It opened up a vista for you about how the brain works, and ultimately you've pioneered tools to help us understand how the brain works using eye movements.
So eye movements are attractive for this kind of inquiry. They're very important. Vision is our most important sense, and if we couldn't see, we wouldn't need eye movements. They allow us to see clearly, and they're easily measured. They're relatively simple compared to trying to move an arm somewhere where it's multiple joints. And the technology developed by my mentor at Johns Hopkins to carefully measure eye movements was ready to be applied to the clinic. So it was just luck and happenstance.
And it may not be evident to everyone who's listening, but motor learning has been an extremely important area of neuroscience. No less so for the way the eyes move, the way the eyes fixate, the way the eyes are impacted by various sensory events that surround them. Tell us a little bit about what eye movements are doing and how they're responding to the environment.
So it became obvious to me that we needed to have basic understanding of the genetics and molecular biology of disease, but patients are going to get sick anyway, trauma, infections, and we need to know how to rehabilitate them. So understanding how the brain responds to disease, trauma, or even just during normal growth and development or aging is critical in thinking of ways to help patients. And in fact, my current interests now, which are in the effects of magnetic fields on the inner ear, go along that path. Vertigo is common. Dizziness is common. Many doctors, when they get a dizzy patient, they become immediately frustrated. They want to send them somewhere else because it's such a complicated area. People have trouble describing, you know, how they're dizzy. But it's actually a great system to learn. It's a critical system in terms of rehabilitation, and it's ripe for investigation. And so our lines of inquiry over the last years have been into people who lose vestibular function, people who have an acute attack of an inner ear infection. How can we make them recover more quickly?
What are the symptoms that these people present with, David?
So they present with dizziness, imbalance, what we call ataxia, incoordination, falls, a sense of being depersonalized. The vestibular system does lots of things to our cognition. It just doesn't make us dizzy and feel spinning, but we feel like we're going to faint, giddy. There's so many ways to describe dizziness because it affects almost every aspect of cognitive function as well as motor function.
And you talked today to the faculty about this notion of homeostasis, about how the brain seeks a set point that allows it to avoid these symptoms and to basically manage itself, to organize itself in space and time. Talk about this magnetic stimulation, this magnetic field work that you're using to understand brain physiology.
So somewhat by chance, as often happens in science, and you need to talk to your colleagues at other institutions, I was speaking with an otolaryngologist friend, and he told me about a discovery he made that he found that patients, when they went in an MRI machine, became dizzy. And he actually recorded their eye movements, and he found that the patients had developed what we call nystagmus, a little jerking of the eyes, as if you were stimulating an inner ear or you had an inner ear infection. So I was very interested in this, came back to Hopkins, got our team going, engineer, physiologist, ENT, rehab, and we began investigating the effects of magnetic fields on the labyrinth. We discovered that magnetic fields stimulate the labyrinth, cause nystagmus, much like spinning around and stopping. But then most recently, we studied the way the brain deals with a superimposed problem like this, where there's an imbalance. And we realized that a major function of the brain is to make sure there is a central balance inside the brain stem, if you will, in the vestibular system. There has to be a tonic level of activity upon which movement is generated. The brain needs to have a set point. It has to set the tone. And this is critical for recovery from any kind of unilateral inner ear problem, for example. So it's this set point adaptation. How does the brain restore tone? A homeostatic mechanism is what we're interested in. And the point you make is that this applies to so many other areas of brain function, not just movement, sensation, even our emotional state. We can be too high or too low, but we have to have a set point that puts us at just the right place. If we're going to make decisions in difficult circumstances, anxious circumstances, you have to have an emotional equipoise. You need a set point. So the lowest motor behaviors, how cells are organized, to the highest cognitive, emotional responses require a mechanism to have the right level of activity, a set point of equilibrium.
And what you talked about today was this word adaptation. So when one stimulates the brain in one way or the other, there's an adaptation. There's a kind of bringing back to the center point or the set point brain function. Do the studies that you're doing now, are they going to help reveal the underlying mechanisms of that adaptation?
So what we thought was that now we had a new way to simulate a lesion in a normal subject so we could study set point adaptation. So in essence, we're creating, the brain is perceiving that there must be a lesion because I have an imbalance, even though we're creating it artificially. And so the brain immediately recognizes this circumstance and tries to restore balance. And what we discovered is that there appear to be multiple time courses of this learning, some on the order of seconds, some on the order of minutes, some on the order of hours, and certainly there are some on the order of days. So what we can do with this new simple way of stimulating a lesion, which is going to cause the brain to adapt, is to quantify this biological behavior. And now we can study in patients, in animal models, with medications, how these different time courses of adaptation come into play with the ultimate goal to facilitate, promote the recovery.
So that's the rehabilitation element of that. If we could just understand how the brain responds to provocations, to insults, to stroke, to infections, that sort of thing, to degenerative disease, if we could just understand how the brain adapts and build and generalize upon the pattern of change that we see in eye movements, in which we induce, if you will, artificially induce, but of course atraumatically induce a lesion, we might learn not just how the brain adjusts itself, but how to help the brain adjust itself.
So that's the point. If we get a handle on the mechanisms, which parts of the brain, what their neurotransmitters are, what the chemical basis of each of these different stages of learning, rehabilitation, adaptation, if you will, then we can devise ways to improve the rate of recovery by new kinds of physical therapy programs, by medicines which promote adaptation. And it's a great example of using a funny finding in the lab that can open a whole new way of trying to study learning, what we call set point adaptation, which could be applicable to all kinds of homeostatic mechanisms in the body.
So David, chart the future for us. What are we going to see in the next 5 or 10 years in terms of the harvest of ideas that come from the work that you're doing?
So what we hope is we will first get a handle on where in the brain these processes are taking place, number one. Number two, what is the mechanism? Is it neurogenesis, new cells? Is it control of inflammation? Is it just a breakdown in the circuit? Is it instability in a circuit? And by studying patients and normal subjects with the right paradigms, we can probably get a good idea of what is going on in each stage of learning, and then we can have an intervention, knowing what the mechanism is.
It's exciting to hear about it. The future is rich, and we thank you very much for your most important contributions to helping us understand our brains.
Great to be here.